Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role did cocaine play in the lives and careers of the first generation of scientists who experiment with it? While cocaine is universally understood today to be highly addictive and dangerous, at the end of the 19th century, it seemed to offer great promise as a stimulant, an antidepressant, and an anesthetic, and that potential attracted some of the greatest medical minds of the day to try it out not only on their patients, but on themselves. Dr. Howard Markel is director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and author of An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine. The book is now available in paperback. Howard, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks for having me.
So indigenous peoples had been chewing coca leaves for, you know, from time immemorial before Western scientists really discovered this substance. How and why was the powdered, concentrated form of cocaine developed?
Well, you're right. Indigenous people, particularly in near the Andes Mountains, where the coca plant grows at about an elevation of 6,000 feet, so right near what is now Bolivia, Peru, et cetera, that's where people used it. But that will give you just like a slightly buzzy sensation, sort of a stimulant, like a cup of coffee. But when explorers started coming to the New World, particularly South America, like Alexander von Humboldt and others beginning in the early 1800s, they heard about these coca leaves and coca teas and how, you know, stimulating, it could make you work longer, you could be more alert and things like that. They brought it back to Europe with them. Now, the thing about leaves, you know, this is a long journey. When you're up in the Andes, you've got to go down on horseback or donkey back, and you're crossing rivers, and you know, this is the 1800s, so you don't have cars or planes or anything like that. So bringing those coca leaves back to Europe was quite a difficult thing. That was a real, as chemists say, a rate-limiting step. It often, by the time it got to Europe, it was rotten or wet or what have you. But they did bring some, and chemists began to play with it. Why does coca leaves have this ability? And it took about, the better part of the 19th century, about 60, 70 years, before chemists, you know, using a little hydrochloric acid here, a little sulfuric acid there, figured out how to extract what's called the alkaloid salt of coca leaves. It's called cocaine hydrochloride. And that's the powdered form that you're referring to, which is far more powerful far more active.
How much did they understand at the time about how it worked and why it worked the way it did in the human body?
Well, they didn't understand much of anything about that. I mean, there's no neurochemistry. No one knows about receptors. And even the concept of addiction is a relatively new phenomenon in the history of medicine. You know, the word addict is really a part of Roman law. It's a legal term. So if I owed you a great deal of money, Chris, and I couldn't pay you back, you'd take me before a judge and I would become your addict. I'd become your slave until I paid it back. Now, I love that, the enslaved part for addiction.
It works beautifully if you think
about
it.
Yeah, it really does. But, you know, and for a long time in the English language, addict referred to any number of bad habits or just compulsive habits, like reading too much. You could be an addict to books or things like that. But it wasn't until about the 1820s or 30s when opium began to be used in Europe. It was used in China and elsewhere, in India, places like that, and the Middle East for a much longer time. And that scientists began to extract an active ingredient out of the poppy plant or opium plant to develop morphine. And morphine was, in the 1820s, the wonder drug. It remains a remarkable drug, and all of its cousins, these opiates, because they were really great painkillers.
Mm-hmm.
They're also very addictive. And as more and more doctors prescribed more and more morphine to people, they discovered that a lot more people were, you know, using it way too much. Well, cocaine came out of the picture about 1884, the powdered cocaine hydrochloride that we just discussed. And that was just pushed by the pharmaceutical companies as the next wonder drug of the year.
Hmm.
You know, the big pharma didn't start yesterday. It's been around a long time. So they advertised, they had their own journals, they enticed doctors with case reports of how, as you mentioned in the intro, it could be used for depression or stimulation. But it was even touted as a potential antidote for morphinism, what we call morphine addiction today.
And there was no such thing back then in the 1880s as a controlled substance.
Not at all, no. I mean, you could go to your druggist actually, you could go to your drugstore until 1914. That's when Congress passed a law called the Harrison Narcotics Control Act, which made the sale of opiates, cocaine, and marijuana, it had to be with a prescription. But before that, you just go to the drugstore and you get whatever you wanted.
Okay, so you searched high and low for evidence that Freud and Halstead might have known each other, and that was to no avail. But it seems almost impossible that they wouldn't have heard of one another. Talk about how their life paths intersected.
Well, they were among the best and brightest in each of their countries. Halstead was American, and Freud from Vienna, Austria. They were both extremely ambitious doctors. Vienna, of course, was the Parnassus of medical education at the time. The University of Vienna Medical School and its hospital, the Allgemeine Krankenhaus, or Vienna General Hospital, was, you know, the place to go and to train. And in fact, about 50% of all American doctors between, I'd say 1860, 1870, and 1920 went to places like Vienna and sometimes Berlin and London and Paris to get extra training after they got their MD. So Halstead, as an American doc, went over to Vienna and had some of the same teachers that Freud had. They clearly walked on the same wards, but I couldn't find that. You know, historians have to have documents to prove things. But I did fantasize, you know, when I was writing the book, that maybe they saw each other across the courtyard of the Krankenhaus or in the cafeteria. But they were orbiting perilously close to one another for over a year between 1878 and 1879.
It's funny to think that this period that we're going to focus on in Freud's life is when he was like in his 20s still in the beginning. And it's funny to think of him before he had sort of the beard and the persona we imagine. Talk about his discovery of the drug and how he felt like it could be used therapeutically.
Well, he did have the beard even then. Mm-hmm. But
it was brown.
He's such a young, youthful man. And people think of Freud as this stern, older, you know, person, as authority, or this great, you know, Freud. But he was a young man, and he was a young man on the make. He really wanted to succeed. He was also Jewish in a very anti-Semitic country, so rising to the top of the heap in the medical circles, he was a little bit handicapped by that. And his goal was to become a professor at the University of Vienna Medical School, which was quite a lofty goal. And to do that, you not only had to be a great doctor, you had to really discover something big, something earth-shaking. So he was always on the lookout. He was doing really kind of anatomical research. He was looking at the brains and spinal cords of various animals and drawing pictures of them and showing how they one neuron related to another. So it was very standard, quantitative, scientific, observational type research that he was doing. But he read a lot. He read several languages, French, German, and English. And he saw a case report in about April of 1884 that talked about cocaine as this new wonder drug and how it could be used as a potential antidote for morphine. Well, he had a very good friend, a wonderful friend named Ernst von Fleischl-Marxo, who was a physician who nicked his thumb doing an autopsy and developed such a raging infection he had the thumb amputated, and he had all sorts of pain after that. And von Fleischl-Marxo became a morphine addict because of that. And Freud, you know, he not only wanted to discover something really big, he wanted to help his friend. So he thought, wow, I can, you know, I can kill two birds with one stone. I can do good as a doctor, and I can, you know, write this up. So he talked to Fleischl-Marxo, gave him the cocaine, and it seemed to work for a few weeks. Fleischl-Marxo stopped taking as much morphine, but as the weeks progressed, he started taking more and more cocaine, and then he started taking more and more morphine. So Freud essentially made him a cocaine and morphine addict. And Fleischl-Marxo died very young, about 6 years later. And Freud always had a great deal of guilt over that. He expressed that.
You would think that after an experience like that, Freud would want nothing to do with trying this drug for himself.
You would think. You would think. As would I. And but one thing that Fleischl-Marxo impressed upon him is that, you know, Sigmund, if you want to get big, you got to write this up. You know, the old saying, publish or perish. And so Freud wrote a 70-page monograph called Uber Coca on cocaine. Unfortunately, he was on cocaine as he wrote on cocaine. He was using himself as the experimental subject. Now, that was very common then and well into the 20th century that doctors would use themselves as guinea pigs. Mm-hmm. And, of course, no one knew at that time how addictive cocaine and how dangerous a drug it was. But it's very interesting when you read that report, this Uber Coca, because first it has the introduction of a very famous literary character, Sigmund Freud, and mm-hmm. he appears in all of his writings after that, you know, Interpretation of Dreams and so on and so forth. But he also, you can tell he's under the influence of cocaine as he's writing this, because he's talking about it, his most gorgeous experiment and what a wonderful, lovely drug this is. And he's really, really going over the top in a way that I have not seen him write before or after.
Yeah, so essentially he's like, I feel great.
Yeah.
and he's recommending this to his wife-to-be and to other patients of his. At the time, he saw no obvious drawbacks.
Yeah, it just seemed to be great. And so he is telling, you know, his fiance is a little bit peaked. He said, well, let's give you some cocaine. I'll send you some. And he's prescribing it or suggesting it to other people as well, because they could only see, you know, the good part of it. And, you know, really, that's true of anyone who enters down that valley of substance abuse and potential addiction. The first couple of hits or whatever are really great. They're really enjoyable.
Is it reasonable to apply that theory that Freud was, in fact, sort of self-medicating for kind of a mild depression at that point in his life?
Well, I think it is reasonable. He was a very nervous fellow, and he was very, you know, whether he had clinical depression, he was kind of a mopey guy. He was very worried if he could ever make it. That was what's so fun about writing the book, is that I got to see Freud as a young guy, as a medical student or a medical resident, and he was just like, I'm a doctor, you know, he's just like every other angst-filled medical student / resident, you know, will I succeed or what? And so he liked the way cocaine made him feel, which is self-medication, absolutely.
Did it change the way he thought about consciousness? I mean, did that altered state of consciousness make a lasting impression on him?
Well, cocaine certainly had an effect on his thinking and some of his ideas. I don't like to ascribe everything he did after that to cocaine. Mm-hmm. It's quite not that simple. But when he was, for example, in Paris in 1886, studying under a neurologist named Jean-Martin Charcot, he took a lot of cocaine, and he's writing to his fiancée, her name was Martha, saying, you know, how great I feel with cocaine and how confident I feel, you know, it takes away my shyness. And then he writes something very interesting to me. He says, cocaine unleashes my tongue and allows me to say things that I thought were locked away forever.
Boy, that's a really interesting phrase from him.
Yeah. That sounds like talk therapy, mm-hmm. right? And he must have known at some point, and after a couple of more problems with cocaine, that wasn't the best tool to achieve that unlocking, that there were better ways, safer ways to go about it.
Yeah, how much can you read between the lines and recognize the point at which he realized he might have a problem or that he needed to quit?
Well, there's a point where he's clearly having a problem, but he's denying it. Mm-hmm. So, which is another cardinal symptom of substance abuse and addiction. So he's writing to a friend of his named Wilhelm Fleece. This is one of his close friends for about 19 years. They ultimately broke up over a fight. Freud used to have friends that he would just break up with later on. And he's writing to Fleece, you know, my nose is so congested that I had to have somebody put a hot knife in to open up a hole. He's having real chest pain and other heart disturbances. He's getting real depressed. And he's also describing how he's taking a lot of cocaine. But he doesn't put two and two together.
Dr. Howard Markell is my guest. He's director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, and he's author of the book An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Center for History, the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, Dr. Howard Markel. He's author of the book An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine. The book is out now in paperback. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Howard, it would be hard to overstate the contributions, real significant contributions that William Halstead made to modern medicine, but he's not quite the household word outside of your business that Sigmund Freud is. Tell us a little bit about his career.
Yeah. I mean, everyone knows who Freud is. And ironically, you know, while Freud is a major intellectual figure in the 20th century or late 19th as well, most of his therapeutic ideas are not that closely followed. I mean, we still do talk therapy and things like that, but they're not as exclusively followed as they were, say, 80 years ago. But William Halstead, whose name, as you're correct, is only known to people in my business, everyone who ever gets off of an operating table alive and well has William Halstead to thank.
Mm-hmm.
He was a remarkably good surgeon, probably the greatest surgeon in the history of medicine, but he did things like invent the rubber glove, the modern iconic symbol of surgery. Also ways to sew wounds together so they heal well, which sounds rather mundane, but it's really, really important. And also the concept of what's called aseptic surgery, where surgeons wear rubber gloves and they gown up and a mask and so on, so they don't introduce any source of infection into the surgical site to prevent a postoperative infection. So these are all measures of safety that he worked on. He also developed a number of surgical procedures, but for just those things alone, he belongs in the Hall of Fame of medicine.
And unlike Freud, his real interest in cocaine initially was related to its properties as a potential anesthetic, which it is, can be used effectively for this.
Yeah, it's a terrific local anesthetic. It's still sometimes used by ear, nose, and throat surgeons. You ever see a cop show where there's a pile of cocaine and the actor will put his finger in the cocaine and touch it to his gums?
Right.
And the reason they're doing that is to test it. It'll numb the gums. It really numbs what are called mucosal membranes, like the inner lining of the nose or the mouth, or if you put it into a solution, you can numb tissue. Now, Freud did miss that. He missed that, much to his chagrin, and he was pretty ticked off about it.
Which is funny, because Freud snorted the stuff, right?
Right. He tended to either snort it or mix it in water.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless of that, either way, you'll still feel some numbing. So I think it speaks to the euphoria that he was experiencing that he kind of missed it. Another guy figured that out, an ophthalmologist named Carl Kohler, and when he reported that, it was in the fall of 1884, that made world news. I mean, front page, not just medical journals, but, you know, New York Times, London Times, the Arbeiter Zeitung of Berlin, you name it, everybody read about it, because there were anesthetics then since the 1840s, ether and chloroform, but they weren't as good as the anesthetics we have now in terms of how long you could keep a patient under.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of vomiting and grogginess and so on. So the idea that you could, you know, use a solution and numb something and the patient was still awake was really quite revolutionary. So Halstead read these papers. And he always on the lookout for something that could improve his surgical technique. He thought, well, gee, if it can numb an eyeball or a gum, why not, you know, put it in a syringe and try to numb deeper and deeper the tissues? And sure enough, he figured out that you could do that, but he used his own arm as the guinea pig.
And it took him like a remarkably short amount of time to become addicted to this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, a thing about addictive drugs, there's a lot of things that come into play. You know, your own personal psychology, the drug you're using, how addictive it is, the amounts that you're using, but also the mode of administration. So putting cocaine on your nose or your tongue is potentially addictive, but it's far less addictive than shooting it into your veins.
Mm-hmm.
That has a direct route to the brain, and so it's a very rapid high. And that's probably what was happening to him. And so in a matter of months, he was a florid addict. He was missing meetings. He wasn't always in the hospital. There was one point, I described this in the book, that he's called down to the what was then called the accident room, we'd call it the ER today, to treat a man with a compound fracture. That's when a bone is actually sticking out of your skin. It's mm-hmm. a very serious injury, and back then people died of it. And he was high on cocaine.
Yeah, like he before he goes in there, he's running around searching for something, and it turns out to be cocaine, so he can have a high, a fix,
right,
before he goes into surgery.
Right, and then he's at the table, and he's the high of cocaine, which is desirable to some for the euphoria and the speeding up, also causes a lot of jitteriness.
Mm-hmm.
You talk very rapidly. Your hands are shaking. You have a tremor. You really don't want a surgeon with a shaky hand. That's good medical advice I'll give to your audience today. But he literally walked away, which is like a captain abandoning the ship.
Mm-hmm.
You're walking away from a patient who needs your help.
So was it sort of an open secret among those who knew Halstead that he had this problem?
No, it was a really closed secret, and he was enabled by a lot of people.
Yeah.
He had a very good friend named William Welsh, who was another great in medicine that may not be well known to a general audience, but William Welsh was the founding dean of the Johns Hopkins Medical School, which was opened in 1889, and to great acclaim, it was going to change, revolutionize how we train doctors, and it did. It changed medical education for the better and put it on a more scientific and rigorous road. Well, Welsh was a New Yorker, and he was from Connecticut originally, but he lived in New York, and he knew Halstead, and he knew something was up. And so he basically did what we call today an intervention.
Mm-hmm.
He took Halstead on a voyage where they were going to dole out, a voyage to the Bahamas, basically, where they were going to dole out less and less doses, smaller and smaller doses of cocaine, and hopefully they could wean him off. That didn't work very well. In fact, Halstead was so hungering, he was jonesing, as they say, so much for the cocaine that he broke into the ship's first aid kit to get a little bit more. So then Welsh sort of said, Luke, you need help. You need to go to a place called the Butler Hospital for the Insane. But I'm about to found this great hospital in Baltimore, and I want you to come as the surgeon, but you got to get clean. So Halstead did commit himself to this insane asylum in Providence, Rhode Island, where he was there for several months. Committing yourself to an insane asylum at circa 1886, that wasn't something you tended to do voluntarily. These were creepy, bad places that you didn't want to go.
Yeah, what were you able to learn about the nature of how an addiction would have been treated in a setting like that in the 19th century?
Well, that was really fun because there were documents of the Butler Hospital that I could get a hold of, including the ledger that, the register that Halstead signed on the day of admission. He just writes William Stewart and then a slash where his last name should be. But you could get a sense of from annual reports and various medical reports how they treated him. And a lot of it was he had a doctor, a very interesting doctor named John Woodbury Sawyer, who talked with him, tried to build up his confidence. They tried to wean him off the cocaine as well and probably succeeded in doing that. There was a lot of what we call today occupational therapy. Halstead would work with his hands. He'd garden. He'd horseback ride. But there was one glitch in his treatment at Butler. He was really jittery and grumpy from the lack of cocaine.
Mm.
And so there's an old saying about doctors, don't just stand there, do something. And we tend to do that. And so they tried everything, sleeping pills and whiskey and what have you. They finally discovered something that could help him sleep at night, and that was morphine.
Hmm.
So in reverse of Freud's friend, Halstead became first a cocaine and then a morphine addict, and he never kicked the habit of either. He for the rest of his life, he probably took morphine every day of his life, and he went on occasional cocaine binges for probably most of the rest of his life as well.
Is it reasonable to assume, Howard, that the extraordinary energy for which Halstead was known was often cocaine fueled?
Well, that's interesting. He had extraordinary energy long before he found cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really a muscular guy who love to operate and work. And when you really track it out, his most productive years in terms of how many operations he is doing or how many papers he's writing versus his most fallow years, the most productive years are when he's trying to lay off the stuff. And you could say the same for Freud, by the way, too. He's least productive when he's using the most cocaine.
And toward the end of his life, he actually acknowledged that, if not in so many words, he said, during this period of my life, I was not that productive.
Yeah, he said I was not that productive, and he regretted the time and health he lost because of this problem. But it was a vague, and because it was so scandalous. Mm-hmm. Here you have the world's greatest surgeon, and he's, but I'm a drug addict, I'm a junkie. They wouldn't use that term then. But so there's all this shame, and there still is a lot of shame and stigma and secrecy attached to addiction. But in the 1890s, there was really a lot of shame and secrecy attached to it.
And let's be frank, there's still a pretty significant problem with drug abuse in the medical community today.
Absolutely. Among doctors, among nurses and pharmacists, people who have access to the keys mm-hmm. where this stuff mm-hmm. is locked up. It's anywhere from 2 to 7% in journal reports of this problem, but I would suspect it's even higher because these things aren't always reported. The one difference between then and now is that we're a lot better in recognizing it, and we are a lot better in getting these impaired physicians and nurses and so on off the wards and into treatment. The opposite was the case in Halstead's day. The doctors who knew about it, Welch and another doctor named William Osler, a great internist, they pretty much covered it up because they didn't want the scandal that would invariably result if it was discovered.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Natalie in Wichita Falls. Hi, Natalie.
Hello, Chris. Wonderful show again.
Thank you.
Comment and question to your guest, please. I'm sure he knows that the original Coca-Cola formula included some form of cocaine. I think that's pretty much a given. And moving on for my question, I would like to know what is known about the cocaine content in Red Bull. Apparently, cocoa leaves are used as a natural flavoring in Red Bull, and apparently it has been de-cocainized. I'm very curious about that when certain acids or alcohol-based chemicals can be used to convert cocoa leaf to a paste.
What do you know about that, Howard?
Well, I talk a lot about Coca-Cola in the book, and I hope you'll avail yourself to read a little bit about it. It was originally one of the first drinks. There were a lot of Coca drinks in the 1880s. One was called Ven Mariani, and that was a red wine mixed with cocaine. A guy in Atlanta, Georgia, John Stith Pemberton, himself a morphine addict because he was a Civil War vet and lost a leg, read that same morphine cocaine antidote paper that Sigmund Freud wrote. So he made his own copycat French coca wine. And after prohibition in Georgia in 1886, he stopped making it as wine and added cola nuts and syrup and soda water to make Coca-Cola, which until 1914 did contain actual cocaine. That's right. In terms of Red Bull, and there are other, in Europe, there are other products that have these coca leaf flavored drinks, but they claim that the cocaine has been extracted out of it. Now, that's certainly possible. There's always likely to be some little trace. But there are so many reasons not to drink Red Bull. It's a nasty substance to be drinking. It races your heart. There's a real crash after you take it. It is loaded with caffeine and other similar compounds. That cocaine is that little tiny bit that may be there is the least of my worries. I see a lot of teenagers as patients, and they love that, and the other products as well. And I'd love to see them drop those cans.
Talk a little bit more about this Ven Mariani, because had they existed in the modern world, they would have had like the world's greatest list of celebrity endorsers.
Yeah, Vin Mariani was created by a chemist named Angelo Mariani. He was Corsican by birth, but he lived in Paris. And he figured out, this was during the cocaine craze, if I added, you know, we have a lot of red Bordeaux wine in France, and he would add about 6 to 8 milligrams of cocaine to it, and you had this tonic that became wildly popular. Well, you know, why not? It had alcohol and cocaine. People like those things, or think they like those things. And also, by the way, we learned many years later that when you mix alcohol and cocaine, the liver metabolizes those two substances into something called coca ethylene, which is more powerful than either one is alone. So he would send cases of the stuff for free to famous people like Thomas Edison or Sarah Bernhardt or the Pope, provided he could use their picture and a little blurb saying, you know, I love Vin Mariani. And indeed, it worked. And he had wonderful ads that are reprinted in a book called The Mariani Album from 1890. And you can see all the ads collected. And, you know, it's a regular who's who of popular cultural stars from Thomas Edison and H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, Sarah Bernhardt.
The Queen?
The Queen, you name it. Yeah, it was the Pope. You know, it just they just got all these great celebrity endorsements, and he probably was the first cocaine millionaire in the history of medicine. It was a wildly popular drink.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Johan calling from Detroit. Hi, Johan.
Hello. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I just had a question for the guest. I was wondering about the rise of Adderall and related substances and the negative effects it's having on the college community as well as other communities around it.
Well, thanks for calling. It's a little off topic, but perhaps because this is your area of expertise, Howard, you wouldn't mind giving us an answer.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of press now about various drugs used for hyperactivity attention deficit disorder, and these are all stimulants or in the amphetamine category. But people who truly have attention deficit disorder have what's called a paradoxical reaction to that amphetamine. Instead of speeding them up, it tends to help them focus. And while that should be the last resort when treating such a patient, you know, that you try to find other ways besides, you know, drugs, for those who truly have that disorder, it's quite helpful. What your guest is referring to, and there's been a lot of press about it lately, is that kids who don't have these problems are taking it to, you know, like you would take speed or caffeine.
They're like study drugs.
Yeah, that's not a good idea. You shouldn't do it. That's the bottom line.
Dr. Howard Markel is my guest. He's director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. His new book is called An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Howard Markel. He directs the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, and he's author of An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. What do we know for sure, Howard, about how Freud was able to kick the habit?
Well, he had a couple of wake-up calls.
That knife in the nose would be one.
Yeah. His health was being impaired, of course. There is a letter to his friend Fleece. It's the day after his father's funeral that he says, by the way, I put the cocaine brush aside. And we never see in any of his, you know, thousands of letters thereafter. He doesn't die until 1939. There's no mention that he's been using cocaine. So it's reasonable to assume that he didn't, although you never really know. But what really got him to think about cocaine as a very dangerous drug was a patient experience. Now, he had a patient named Emma Eckstein, mm-hmm. and he was treating her for hysteria, which is an old 19th century disease where you have these physical responses to psychological trauma, and she had a whole bunch of them, and she wasn't getting better. And so he thought, well, maybe something organic, maybe something in her body is going on, so he called a consultant, and that was his friend Fleiss, who lived in Berlin and trained into Vienna. Now, Fleiss had Freud had some very odd theories compared to his colleagues back then, but so did Fleiss. Fleiss thought that all systems of the body were controlled by the nose. You could regulate the menstrual cycle, the reproductive cycle, what have you, through manipulations of the nose. And what he would recommend to his patients is a surgical removal of a bone in the nose called the turbinate and then painting it with cocaine. Well, that's exactly what he recommended to Emma Eckstein. Freud himself was using cocaine the night before this operation and may have been still under the influence on the day of the operation. And Fleiss did it, and then he went home to Berlin, and Emma got sicker and sicker and sicker. And the room smelled really bad. It smelled like gangrene. Hmm. And basically, Freud called in another ear, nose, and throat man who found a meter length of gauze in the wound. So Fleiss left the sponge in the patient, so to speak. And Emma Eckstein nearly died, and they somehow resuscitated her. Her face was
destroyed,
disfigured. Yeah, on that side. Well, then Freud had to have known at some level if this was discovered. I mean, this is not a current-day definition. That would be malpractice. And if that was discovered, there would be no Sigmund Freud as we know him. His career would have been over. And so this is right around the same time, he's thinking his father dies, he quits the cocaine, and he's starting to write what becomes his most famous book, The Interpretation of Dreams. And the model dream of interpretation of dreams, the central dream, is one of his own where he's at a party. It's called Irma's Dream. He's at a party, and Irma is in a ball gown. There's all of Vienna's finest. And around her on the floor are bloody syringes and bandages and what have you. And she says in front of everyone, "Dr. Freud, you nearly killed me." And so Freud really worked this out in his mind. Why am I having this dream? Well, you don't have to be a psychologist to figure that out.
Yeah.
But Freud said he came to the conclusion that, well, here's why. I'm so invested in my patients that if they go sour, I feel their pain.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about dreams or wish fulfillment. So cocaine had a lot of impact on his career.
Mm-hmm.
Undeniable.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Adrian in Dallas. Hi, Adrian.
Hi. Throughout this conversation, I've been thinking a lot about Arthur Conan Doyle and his character Sherlock Holmes, both of whom were cocaine addicts. And I'm not real clear on the dates, but it seems like it was really about the same time. And that was pretty popular literature. I just wondered how... how well known these addictions were in the mm-hmm. in the culture.
You're right, and I talk about that in the book. Arthur Conan Doyle was a physician and was a young physician at the time, and he was reading the same papers in the 1880s as Freud was about cocaine. He probably tried a little bit of it and certainly prescribed it. The Sherlock Holmes stories don't really begin until 1890, a little bit after. But you're right, Sherlock Holmes liked 7% solution of cocaine and was quite an addict. And so by the 1890s, the addictive part of cocaine was better, at least somewhat understood, that you're having enough patients coming in with problems that they began to recognize that this was a problem. Here's a really interesting tidbit. Freud loved Sherlock Holmes stories. He was a big fan of Arthur Conan Doyle, so... Do with that what you will.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, Sherlock Holmes liked to work through what the truth must be based on what he was able to observe about characters' behavior.
Absolutely. And Sherlock Holmes's deductive reasoning is based on a physician's approach to a disease.
Hmm.
In fact, Sherlock Holmes is based on a doctor, a man named Joseph Bell, who was Conan Doyle's teacher in Edinburgh. So there is a real medical approach to the way he tries to solve a crime or figure out what's going on.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Charlie in Lakewood. Hi, Charlie.
Hello. Several years ago, I read a front page article in the Wall Street Journal which said that there was one lawful manufacturer of cocaine in the United States, that they received carloads of the coca leaves and they refined it into cocaine. Their main two customers, their only two customers, was the pharmaceutical industry that used it in a salve so that you could kill the nerves in the gums before the Novocaine is injected. And their second customer was Coca-Cola, who used it in their secret flavor formula.
Well, I don't know that article. There is cocaine is still used in a liquid form. I think it's Merck, the company that makes it, but I'm not sure. But that is used particularly by ear, nose, and throat surgeons as a local anesthetic. You mentioned lidocaine and novocaine, which are synthetic versions of cocaine, but they numb you, but they don't get you high. And that is much more common and a much better way of going to do local anesthesia. There are jellies and salves that contain lidocaine or novocaine that will numb you a little bit before you put the needle in. I don't know of anyone. I've never heard or seen anyone use cocaine salve in the way that you just described it. Coca-Cola is supposed to not have any cocaine in its products. They may use some type of coca leaf for flavoring, as the person who called about Red Bull. But the problem is that is a top secret. Nobody really knows what the formula for Coca-Cola is. But I can tell you with certainty there is no cocaine in Coca-Cola.
I want to be careful how I phrase this next question because I do not want it to sound in any way like an endorsement of drug abuse by anybody. But I wonder if you think there is something about the sort of risk-taking personality of people who might be susceptible to becoming addicted to drugs that in other situations, in ideal situations, could also lead them to take the kinds of professional risks that in both Freud's and Halstead's case led to significant success and discoveries.
Yeah. Well, you know, most addicts are, if you treat them, and I have, they're great risk takers. And, they like thrills, whether it's driving fast or simply, you know, if you inject a drug, you don't know if it's a good, if you buy it on the street, you know if it's good or poison or if you're going to wake up or what have you. So you are flirting with death all the time. Surgeons tend to be great risk takers. They like to operate. They like to open people up. They don't know if that patient's going to recover or even, you know, wake up from the operation. And it does take a certain boldness to, as one of my surgery professors used to say, to work on a motor while the engine is still running. Similarly, Sigmund Freud was a great risk taker because he was leaving the quantitative, numerical, staid type of scientific research that was then, you know, then being done in Vienna for this very, subjective, descriptive feelings and such, you know, of the mind. And it was not thought to be a terribly scientific method. So there are risk takers who use their risk taking for good things, and there are other risk takers who don't. And that's a very difficult situation to divine. And so are you being lucky that you put your risk-taking into your work? Well, it depends. It depends on how great the risks are. And certainly, substance abuse is a huge risk. I think there are much better ways to exercise your risk-taking behavior than taking drugs.
Do you think we're more effective at treating people who have substance abuse problems now that at least the medical community looks at this largely as a medical problem as opposed to a sort of character flaw?
I think we're much better at it, certainly, than the days of Sigmund Freud and William Halstead, but we still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
It is not, you know, many people do attach stigma and secrecy to it, but many other people don't, and you can see that by how common rehabs are and the treatments and 12-step programs and things like that that really do work wonders. Having said that, when you take 100 addicts and you treat them, or 100 alcoholics too, and I consider all these addictions, you know, the substance is irrelevant, frankly. You know, if you take 100 of these guys, 66 of them will relapse before the end of the year. So you don't have a great track record.
Yeah.
But there are people whose lives are literally saved by getting off the stuff and being taught about what are triggers and some of the things that might underlie their addiction, and also joining a very good 12-step group that can help them, you know, day-to-day manage their addictive problems. But we got to do a lot better. As a colleague of mine once said, you know, for something like addiction, we need many arrows in our quiver. There are some pharmaceutical solutions on the horizon and some that already exist. There's even vaccines that develop antibodies to, say, cocaine so that you wouldn't even get high if you took the cocaine, and that might diminish urges and things like that. There are drugs on the drawing board that would diminish people's urges so they could think it through before they picked up the drug.
I have to wonder, Howard, if doing all this research, you come to sort of, you know, you want to root for your protagonist, and there have to be multiple examples throughout the course of this where you're like, oh, come on, guys, not again.
No, because I treat a lot of addicts, and I know how chronic, relapsing, remitting the disease is. It's
yeah.
a crafty disease, mm-hmm. and it's a heck of a disease they have to deal with. I actually grew to like both of them very much, and particularly Halstead, which surprised me because I'm not a surgeon. I'm a pediatrician. We're very different types of doctors. But I felt so badly for particularly for Halstead that he was just stuck in this terrible, terrible cycle.
Mm-hmm. Do you any doubt at all that the federal government did the right thing in 1914 when it began to control addictive substances?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't think there's a black and white yes or no answer to that. You know, certainly the war on drugs and criminalizing drug abuse is not working very well. You know, about 60 to 70% of our entire jail population are for petty drug crimes, and that's a lot of money that could be used for better things, including treatment. I think we're down that road, and I'm not advocating legalization of things, but I think we need to have better approaches, and instead of making it a criminal issue, making it a medical and public health issue.
Mm-hmm. We have time for one more quick call. Allison is on the line in Arlington. Hi, Allison.
Hi. I was listening earlier, and you mentioned something about taking cocaine and alcohol and it turning into coca ethanol, I think you said.
Coca ethylene. Yeah.
Coca ethylene? Okay. You said it was much more powerful. How much more powerful is it? How does it affect you negatively?
Well, I couldn't quantify it like it's 2 or 3 or 4 more times powerful, but when you mix the two, cocaine and alcohol, the liver metabolizes into this product. So you feel drunker and you feel speedier than you would if you just took one alone. So they potentiate each other. They increase each of those units. The sum is greater than the parts.
What was your favorite thing to discover about these two guys that you had not known before you began this research?
Oh, gosh. It was great to see Sigmund Freud as a nervous young medical student filled with angst. That mm-hmm. just warmed my heart because I was the same way.
You can relate.
Uh-huh. I can totally relate. And it was also nice or actually very edifying in terms of my own study of addiction to see the sadness and the damage that Halstead's life, that drugs brought to Halstead's life. You know, some people have said, well, there's no collateral damage because he was such a great surgeon. Well, you don't know much about addiction because it not only harmed him, it harmed people around him. And that's what substance abuse and addiction does. It harms relationships and all sorts of things that the addict himself doesn't even realize.
Dr. Howard Markell is director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and author of An Anatomy of Addiction, Sigmund Freud, William Halstead, and the Miracle Drug Cocaine. Howard, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free every day at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.